ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID, the Future. I'm Eric Anderson, and today I'm pleased to be joined again by a Dr. Eric Hedin to continue our discussion of canceled science, what some atheists don't want you to see. Dr. Hedin earned his PhD in experimental plasma physics and has taught physics and astronomy at Taylor University and Ball State University in Indiana and at Biola University in Southern California. His research has focused on computational nanoelectronics and higher dimensional physics. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you very much, Eric. It's great to be back.
So last time we talked about the boundaries of science, which was a course you taught at Ball State University, and some of the key issues we all need to watch out for as we engage in this wonderful and exciting enterprise of science. We discussed the importance of critical thinking, whether we should expect science to have all the answers, whether the naturalistic assumption that's so common in science these days is warranted, and the importance of making up our own minds. We also touched upon some of the really big issues, such as our ability to understand nature, free will, and the many things that, quite frankly, make life meaningful and precious. I really encourage readers to pick up a copy of the book and dive into these in more detail. Today, however, I'd like to jump into some of the fascinating discoveries about our universe.
Well, that sounds great. I'll look forward to our discussion.
Before we dive into the science, I want to just tie off the prior discussion with one final point, and that's the idea of methodological naturalism. In Chapter 3 of the book, you talk about a science education initiative called the Hallmarks of Science, which included some premises about how science should be done. The first premise says, modern science seeks explanations for observed phenomena that rely solely on natural causes. And then you write, the idea that scientific explanations have to rely only on natural causes, you write, begins to feel particularly suspect and dogmatic when applied to the question of the origin of nature itself. Why do you say that?
Well, if we consider nature itself and we're restricted to only considering natural causes, then that would force one to adopt a circular reasoning approach, because you would have to say that nature causes itself to come into existence. If you're only seeking natural causes for the origin of nature.
Right.
I think that there's just basically a logical dilemma there. How can something cause itself to come into existence?
Yeah.
Another aspect of that premise of the so-called hallmarks of science, which is really just some statements that were put into an astronomy textbook that I used to teach out of, but again, to insist that modern science only seek explanations for observed phenomena that rely on natural causes, that's actually a good idea when one is doing science. For example, if you're trying to explain the origin of a rainbow from a scientific perspective, you wouldn't really want to come up with the answer that didn't rely on natural causes. You know, you wouldn't want to say, well, a rainbow is just caused by God smiling at us or something like that. And, you know, Maybe there is some sort of a theological connection with a rainbow. I'm not saying there isn't, but as a scientific explanation, that isn't really satisfactory. So I understand the premise, but my objection to it is, what if scientific observations about nature come to conclusions that suggest that nature itself is inadequate to produce a particular scientific outcome, such as the origin of the universe, or even something within the universe, such as the origin of life? So I feel like it might be wise and perhaps a little more reasonable to allow this first premise about only natural causes, to allow that premise to be set aside or revised if, in fact, our study of nature suggests that there is no natural cause that can account for this particular natural phenomenon. Natural in quotes there.
Right. And I liked your example about the rainbow. That's a phenomenon that we can see repeatedly, regularly, over and over. It tends to occur in the same types of circumstances. And so it's sort of a classic, great example of the exact type of thing where we would want to find a regular natural cause that occurs for that. But if you're looking at something like, where did the universe come from? Or how did life begin? These are not repeatable, regularly occurring phenomena, number one.
Yes.
And number two, there's not a directly amenable material explanation for them. And so we ought to be able to say, hey, does science per se as science have to be tied into this? What does it say? Must rely solely on natural causes is the way they put it in the hallmarks of science. When in fact, the science that we're doing suggests that it's not just a purely natural and unguided cause.
Yes, and I believe that it might be worthwhile just to address kind of a response that is often put forward that, well, if we don't have a natural cause explanation for something, the origin of the universe or the origin of life yet, then all we need to do is wait, hold on, allow science and the development of our understanding of nature to progress. And within a few years, we will undoubtedly find a natural explanation for these as of yet unexplained phenomena. However, what I have found as a scientist is that we have already, within the realm of science, come to an understanding of what nature can do that already precludes a natural explanation for some of these kinds of phenomena that I've just mentioned. The origin of life is one, the origin of consciousness is another, and you know, the origin of the universe, as we explained earlier, just from a logical perspective, really isn't conducive to that kind of an explanation.
Yeah, and this idea that, hey, we just need more time, we need more funding, we need more, just wait, we'll figure it out. I think Mike Behe referred to that in one of his books as the promissory note, at least in the evolutionary context, that never gets paid. I mean, we continue to say, wait and ask more. But it's not a question of we don't have any, and this is a really important point, it's not a question of we don't have any information, and so therefore we can't draw a conclusion, so we need to wait until we get more information. We have a lot of information. We have really good information that can allow us to draw a reasonable and thoughtful conclusion about the cause of some of these kinds of things that we're talking about. So it's not at all like, hey, this is something that we're first coming at for the first time and just barely starting to think about it. So we need to stop and take time. No, let's look at the evidence we've got.
Yes.
And let's have the, you know, the professional courage and the intellectual integrity to draw the conclusion that the evidence is speaking to us with.
Yes, and I try to make this point in my book. And if you read the book, you'll catch on to this, that science has already learned an awful lot about nature. And that's reflected in a lot of the technology that we use. And based on what we already know, we can also say things that science can't do, meaning nature has limits. We've learned that nature is not just a genie in a bottle, that if you just approach it the right way, it can do anything.
Yeah. So talk to us about the universe. Can science speak to whether nature, or we'll say the universe we observe as a whole, had a beginning and therefore had a cause?
Yes, it certainly can. And that is the modern story of cosmology. Probably began in the early 1900s. We have evidence from observations, usually attributed to Edwin Hubble using the Wilson Observatory, finding that galaxies outside of our own Milky Way, on average, are moving away from us. And it led to the idea of the expanding universe. And again, this may seem, if you're not familiar with the idea, it may seem a little strange just hearing that. Again, it's developed more thoroughly in the chapter in the book on this. But an expanding universe means that it's getting larger as time goes on. The space between galaxies is spreading out as time goes on. Now, if you just think about putting the movie in reverse, running time backwards, that means as you go back in time, the universe was smaller, galaxies were closer together, and if you go back in time far enough, everything would have been together in a single point. All matter, energy, space, time, everything would have been together in a single point. And that's what we call the beginning of the universe, because it can't really get any smaller than a single point. And so it observationally, logically, leads us to that conclusion. And then there's a theoretical underpinning of these observations, and this is Einstein's general theory of relativity, which was published some years, about 13 years before Hubble's groundbreaking observations. And Einstein's general theory of relativity speaks to the fabric of space and time itself and gives us an understanding that space itself can expand. And so when we see galaxies moving away from us, it's not just like shrapnel flying out from a hand grenade through space, but it's space itself expanding in like wind carrying leaves. The expansion of space carries the galaxies apart with it. And again, if you reverse this, you come back to what's known as a singularity, a point of infinite density of matter, a point of infinite smallness, perhaps only modulated slightly by quantum effects, but the quantum effects at the beginning of the universe are beyond our current physical understanding and not fully explained by any theory that we have, needing a quantum theory of gravity. But even if such a theory were to be developed, it doesn't negate the point that there was a beginning to the universe.
Right. Yeah, you mentioned Hubble and Einstein. I remember there's this wonderful photo op where Einstein came out and visited Hubble, and they're standing at Mount Wilson looking through the telescope and have this wonderful photo op that they did there, because Einstein, of course, was very interested in Hubble's work and with others, right, beyond Hubble, but certainly came out and, yes, and met Hubble and had that experience. Now, you're down in Southern California right now. You ought to go visit. Have you been to visit the observatory?
Well, yes. I was just going to say that I had a chance to visit the Mount Wilson Observatory, which is still an active astronomical place, although the main telescope isn't used for astronomical research anymore.
Used for tours now.
Yes, but there are other telescopes there that have been built.
Yeah, sure.
In more recent years. Yeah, there was a photograph of Einstein there in one of the observatory rooms. And there was also a photograph of Hubble's, I guess, plate that he, the photographic plate that he printed of the distant galaxy that showed the Cepheid variable star that led to the understanding of the expansion of the universe. And so it was a lot of fun just to take in that sort of a historical environment there.
Awesome. Yeah, no, that's fantastic. So tell us about anything else that you want to mention in terms of evidence for the beginning.
Well, there are other lines of reasoning that support this idea. One of them has to come from physics again, the laws of thermodynamics, which suggest very strongly that the available usable energy in the universe should be diminishing with time. And we note that the universe still has a lot of available usable energy, such as what comes from our sun. And since we still have this kind of energy, we know that the universe has not completely run down yet. It is not, therefore, infinitely old. Mm-hmm. So this concept of the second law of thermodynamics also suggests that our universe must have begun in the finite past, not the infinite past. It would have run down if it was infinitely old.
Yeah, this was particularly, I thought, a powerful point, that things are still active, things are still going, we haven't run down, and also relates to the light from the stars that we can still see in a similar vein. I mean, it's a different argument, but slightly different vein. Tell us about that.
Well, light from distant stars is still visible to us, partially because they're not infinitely far away. And if the universe, as we see it expanding, had been expanding for an infinite amount of time, these stars would have been carried out beyond what's known as the cosmic horizon. And this is a sort of a point beyond which we cannot see, yet we can still see the light from stars. So again, it indicates that our universe is not infinitely old. And then there's another aspect of discovery within cosmology that is strong evidence for the validity of this beginning of our universe in a hot, condensed state. And this discovery was predicted before it was actually seen. It's known as the cosmic microwave background radiation. It's background radiation within the cosmos, and it's in the microwave part of the spectrum. And it is like a leftover heat glow from the beginning of the universe, when it was hotter and denser. And then as it began to expand, this radiation became sort of free to travel through space. There's a lot of detail here I'm leaving out in this quick overview, but the point is that scientists in the 1960s discovered this microwave background radiation, and it had exactly the form or the spectrum that matched the theoretical predictions based on the Big Bang model of the universe. And I think it's just fascinating that humans, with all of our limitations, can in fact have really learned something about the origin of our own universe and learned enough to be able to predict based on physics theories and then find observations that match that. And it's really quite a phenomenal accomplishment when you think about it.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, those are some great lines of evidence for a beginning for our universe. Talk to us a little bit now about fine-tuning. Most of our listeners will have heard of that, but briefly, what are you referring to? And maybe give us a couple of examples.
Well, thank you. I'll do that. The idea of the fine-tuning of physical constants and parameters of our universe is important and relevant because it suggests that our universe is not just a random event. It's not just something that has no design or no intention to it. So when we find things that are designed that seem to fit something to achieve a purpose, we expect that there was a designer, that there was some engineer or intelligence behind it. And so it is with our universe. As we measure the parameters of the universe, we find that these parameters are fixed at values that allow life to exist. And we have no underlying theory of physics that demands that these parameters be fixed at these life-sustaining values. There's a lot of talk, a lot of books written, a lot of discussion about the meaning of this, and there's counter-arguments. So I'm not saying that this is just a trivial, no-contest proof of, say, the origin of a universe according to a theistic model, but it is entirely consistent with that model. So let me just mention a couple of these fine-tuning parameters. One has to do with the universe and its expansion, just like we were talking about. Scientists can measure the rate of the expansion of the universe, and it turns out to be a rate which is very finely tuned. Some have estimated that it needs to be finely tuned to within one part in 10 to the 60th. This is an enormously large number, so like a knife edge fine tuning. What would happen if the universe expanded more quickly than it did? Well, then the matter and energy, the particles of the universe would spread out too quickly before gravity had a chance to coalesce them into stars and galaxies. And we need stars and galaxies for life to exist. On the other hand, if the expansion of the universe had been a little bit slower, in that case, gravity would have had a chance to collapse material together too quickly, too efficiently, and the result would have been, as one author put it, a mess of black holes, a mess of super gigantic black holes. And this wouldn't be particularly conducive for sustaining life either.
Yeah, exactly.
There are counterarguments about this having to do with the theory of inflation, as it's called, an inflationary epoch in the early universe. But that theory also has fine-tuning embedded in it to have it come out in such a way that the universe could sustain life. So how you look at it, you've got this fine-tuning built into the expansion of the universe.
Yeah. Maybe share one more example of fine-tuning with us.
Sure. Another one has to do with some of our fundamental particles within the universe. Most people who've taken a science class know that all matter is made up of three fundamental particles, protons and neutrons and electrons. And they make up our atoms. The electrons are negatively charged, protons are positively charged. Turns out that there's a force between those, the electric force. And it's actually a very strong force compared to the force of gravity. So to keep the electric force from overwhelming the gravitational force, what we need is charge neutrality. Simply put, there's got to be a balance between the number of electrons and the number of protons throughout the entire universe. How finely balanced? To within one part in a trillion times a trillion times a trillion. That's pretty finely balanced, I'd say.
Yeah.
And it turns out that we have this balance. This is all the more remarkable when you tie it in with the Big Bang model for the origin of the universe, in which protons and neutrons stopped forming out of energy before electrons stopped forming out of energy. And yet, in the end, they end up with this almost exact same number. That's also interesting because electrons are a completely different kind of particle than protons. They're almost 2,000 times less massive. Electrons are very lightweight particles. They have different fundamental particle characteristics. And yet we end up with this ultra knife edge balance between the numbers of these particles, which is essential for allowing a universe to form stars, and stars are essential for life.
Sounds a little suspicious to me.
Well, I think so. And I like to point this out in a class, then let students think about it. I mean, the fact that we have this balance is, there's no argument. I mean, it is there. And we have no physical explanation for why it has to be this way. But it does have to be this way for us to exist.
Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. Aren't scientists still searching for an overarching theory of everything that would help explain the fine-tuned properties of our universe without the need of any guidance or any intelligence?
So scientists are, in fact, looking for a theory of everything, but without success so far. It's been a real goal of science to find such a thing. But let's imagine that they were successful in finding a theory of everything. And this theory of everything is defined to be a theory that explains all of the parameters that we have in the universe, why things are the way they are, the masses of everything, the charges of everything, the numbers of particles and the forces and so on. Well, we don't have such a theory, but if such a theory was found and it explained why all the parameters of physics came out in such a way so as to sustain life, then the next question is, I think it's a question that a child would ask. Well, why does the theory of everything have this property that it causes all of the physical parameters to be perfect for sustaining life? So if a theory of everything explained all the life-friendly parameters of physics, then we would just simply step back a step and ask, why does the theory of everything come out that way to sustain life rather than come out another way where life would be impossible?
Yeah, so you're not getting away from the need to explain the fine-tuning. You're just saying there was fine-tuning at another level that then produced the fine-tuning that we're observing.
Yes, exactly right.
One aspect I found particularly interesting in your book was how the time frame of our existence, meaning life on Earth, how that time frame fits within the overall time frame of the universe.
Well, I've found this to be very interesting for myself as well, and that's one reason I wanted to write about it in the book. And honestly, it's included in the book because there have been a lot of questions from my students over the years, as I've taught astronomy, for example, about the timing of the development of life on Earth or the formation of Earth within the history of the universe. The question often is, why so old? Another might just be, why did the Earth form when it did? Well, let me just set the boundaries of this a little bit. According to the Big Bang model of the universe came into existence about 13.8 billion years ago. Sounds like a phenomenally long time ago, but actually it's not so long if you compare it to the lifespans of the most common stars. The most common stars in our universe are smaller stars known as red dwarfs, and their lifespans easily run up to 100 billion years. So in their world, the age of the universe is not particularly old at all. But anyway, within this universe, it took about 9+ billion years before the Earth came into existence. And again, 9 billion years seems like such a long time. Well, why wait so long? One answer comes from our understanding of what is needed to generate or to form a planet like Earth. Earth is not just made of gas, of course. It has solid material in it, silicates, rocky materials, and metals in its core, being primarily iron, for example. Well, in the early universe, there were none of these metals. In the early universe, there wasn't even any carbon, which is the basis of all organic life. Where did these elements come from? And it's through a process generally referred to as stellar nuclear synthesis, the synthesis of nuclei, heavier nuclei, and that occurs within the cores of massive stars. So these stars had to go through their life cycles, sometimes millions of years, and they had to reach the end of their lives, and then new generations of stars had to carry on. And the whole process of enriching the universe with heavier elements, elements that are necessary to form Earth and the things on Earth, took a lot of time. And scientists estimate it probably took about 9 billion years to get roughly the correct ratios of heavier elements to even form a planet with a solid surface and a metallic core such as Earth.
Mm-hmm. And why is the core important?
Well, the core of Earth, even though we don't see it, you know, if you just stand on the ground and you have to think, okay, if I drilled down 4,000 miles straight down, I would reach the center of the Earth. That's a long ways away. So we don't often think about that core buried deep down there, but it is essential for life on Earth. We need a metallic core, primarily iron, nickel, ferromagnetic materials, in order to produce our magnetic field. And we could talk about this a little bit more in a future discussion, but the magnetic field is essential for preserving life on Earth. And also that core needs heavier metals that are even radioactive, undergoing decay that releases energy and keeps it hot to drive plate tectonics. And that helps to recycle materials and is part of our climate control mechanism. There's a lot that's essential there to maintain the livability of Earth over the long period of time that it has existed.
So that's excellent on the front end of the time frame, meaning from the beginning of the universe until the time when the Earth was formed, I don't have a lot of margin for difference there. But what if the Earth had formed a lot later? Let's say after the universe were 50 billion years old, what would be the situation then?
Well, it turns out that there is a boundary or a limit on how late the Earth could have formed within the history of the universe as well. So if it forms too early, there would be insufficient heavy elements having been built up by stars running through their life cycles, through stars undergoing supernova explosions that spread those heavy elements around, and they can be then incorporated into the next generation of stars. But if the Earth formed too late, the other issue is that there would be too few of the kinds of stars that the Earth needs as a sun. The types of stars that are younger, such as our sun, they formed maybe only about 4.5 billion years ago. They don't have lifespans that run into tens of billions of years, maybe only 10 billion years, and our sun's life is over. So if the Earth formed much later in the history of the universe, there would be fewer of these types of stars like our sun. There might be only left some of the smaller stars that have longer lifespans. But the smaller stars have a problem if you have a planet orbiting them. To get enough heat out of a smaller star, you've got to orbit closer. And if you orbit too close to a star, this phenomenon known as tidal locking kicks in, which slows down the rotation rate of the planet until its rotation rate is almost as long as its year, in which it keeps one face towards the star and the other face towards the cold of space. So one side is in the oven and the other is in the freezer. Not particularly good for a healthy climate.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this late time kind of boundary for when the Earth could form. We also need those heavy elements that are radioactively decaying within the core of the Earth to help maintain the heat and the molten core and driving plate tectonics and the magnetic field production. All of those radioactive elements eventually decay away, and so they no longer exist in as great abundance in an older universe.
Yeah, so they last an awfully long time, but based on compared with our lifetimes, but they're not eternal and they will run down. Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Good. Well, Eric, thank you for being with us today to help us understand more about the remarkable universe we live in and the discoveries that point to a plan and a purpose underlying it all. I hope we can have you back again soon to tell us more.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed talking with you again, just sharing some highlights. All these ideas are developed much more thoroughly in the book itself.
Excellent. Thank you for joining us for this episode of ID the Future. To learn more about these fascinating scientific discoveries that point to a cause for our universe and the remarkable fine-tuning that enables life, get your copy of Canceled Science today in paperback or ebook format at online retailers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.